On the Burning Archive this week, I talked to Sam Roggeven, one of Australia's leading defence foreign policy analysts, about Australia's role in the world and what the lessons for US allies like Australia are of growing tensions with China and of recent wars, including in Ukraine.
And what I think they should be learning is that if you get into a war with a nuclear-armed great power, you will get a lot of support from the Americans. You'll get arms. You'll get diplomatic support. You will get sanctions support. You will get intelligence support. But will you get American troops? Probably not. Now, the obvious counter-argument here is, well, Taiwan is not Ukraine. Taiwan's much more important to Ukraine. But my response to that is simply, well, you maybe haven't thought through the consequences of going to war with China. You haven't thought through the full consequences, which actually ends at a nuclear exchange and possibly the extinction of the human species, right?
Welcome, everyone. This is Jeff Rich from The Burning Archive. The Burning Archive is a podcast where I try to help you see the world more clearly with a little bit of quality world history. There are a few areas more than foreign policy and defence policy where seeing the world clearly with a bit of quality world history is not more important. And I had the privilege, really, of sitting down with Sam Roggeven, the Director of International Security Program at the Lowy Institute, Australia's leading foreign policy think tank. And Sam talked about his book, The Echidna Strategy, Australia's Search for Power and Peace, published by La Trobe University Press in 2023. Before joining the Lowy Institute, Sam was a bit like me. He was a bureaucrat, but a very different kind of bureaucrat. He worked as an analyst in Australia's peak intelligence agency, the Office of National Assessments, and has done work on North Asian strategic affairs, nuclear strategy, and Asian military affairs, and has also worked on arms control policy in the Department of Foreign Affairs, and as an analyst in the Defence Intelligence Organisation. And in 2023, he wrote a book which was a bit of a breakout book for him called The Echidna Strategy, Australia's Search for Power and Peace, which really proposed a defensive strategy for Australia rather than an aggressive strategy, which perhaps you could describe AUKUS and the acquisition of nuclear submarines as being. And he also advocated some really innovative ideas around regional diplomacy for Australia and reconsiderations of how we relate to the United States of America in a changing multipolar world. I think you'll really enjoy this conversation with Sam Roggeven, and you can also watch it on my YouTube channel, the Burning Archive YouTube channel. But you can also just go for a walk out into sunshine and listen to Sam and I talk about Australia's place in the world and what it took for Sam as, a member of the, foreign policy defence community to write a book which proposed a very different strategy for Australia on foreign and defence policy. Hello, Sam Roggeven. Welcome to the Burning Archive podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, Jeff.
Sam, your book, The Echidna Strategy, has been quite a sensation in Australia over the last, 6 months or so, because you've sort of questioned the, what Hugh White calls the unthinking American alliance. You've proposed an alternative defence strategy, and you've even sort of proposed perhaps some different directions for foreign policy in Australia. It seems to me that it's taken quite a bit of courage on your part, because you're ex-intelligence analyst and they're senior person at the Lowy Institute, Australia's leading think tank. What's it been like for you over the last 6 months or so? putting out that sort of position.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate the compliment. And it's not, it's generally considered impolite to throw compliments back in someone's face. So, but I will need to, I will need to push back gently against the claim of courage, although much as I appreciate it, I can't take that entirely at face value, in the sense that I work in an incredibly supportive environment at the Lowy Institute, where free thinking is encouraged. I also happen to live in one of the freest countries in the world, where free thought is not punished, and there is no intimidation of people who, you know, who publish ideas that maybe a little that challenge the status quo or are slightly outside the mainstream. So, you know, compared to people in other countries who take those kind of positions, I'm very privileged. I always try to remember that and be humble and thankful for it. The book has been a success, and I think overall what I have to say is that rather than me having to take a risk or lose any skin over it, ultimately it's been very beneficial for me professionally. I think my status has risen professionally. I get invited to do conversations like this one, which I wouldn't have before. Alan Gingell, actually, a few years ago, was the person who encouraged me to write this book when I had my doubts about whether to do it. The late Alan Gingell, who a lot of us in the foreign policy community miss very dearly. So I've got Alan to thank, actually, for encouraging me to do it, and I'm pleased I did it. It's been a great benefit to me, and I hope some benefit to the people who've read it.
I did notice, and perhaps courage wasn't quite the right word, but there was a sense of real, I guess, ethical responsibility, I guess, I felt in the book. And there was one, particularly in your little passage where you talk about whether Australia should, I guess, go to war with China over Taiwan. You say there, if I just quote, if it comes to that, Australia would have a solemn duty to the entire world to prevent the very worst from happening, because the real enemy would be war itself. And that sense of, I guess, responsibility to the world, I guess, was one of the things that I felt really I admired about your book.
Oh, that's kind, and I'm glad that, thank you, and I'm glad you picked up on it. I do feel that way, and I did try to wrestle at the beginning of, I think the quote you just read out there is from the end of the book, but I did try to wrestle at the beginning of the book with competing ethical quandaries. On the one hand, I think it's important in any book related to defence policy in Australia, and it's too seldom done, to talk about the opportunity cost of defence spending and the fact that actually you are ultimately, you know, taking in a metaphorical sense, the food out of babies' mouths. You know, the money that government spends every year ideally always goes towards human flourishing in various forms, whether that's to helping the least worst off amongst us to live in dignity, or whether it's to improve our education system or our health system or what have you, or if it comes to that, to give more money back to our taxpayers so that they can choose how to spend their money. Defence spending is in every sense a waste, an unfortunate waste, but an inescapable one too. So not only is it ethically difficult to justify defence spending, it's also an ethical duty to defend Australia, because whatever faults our nation may have, none of them are going to be made better if it's a country that is somehow under the thumb or under the subjugation of a foreign power. Australia's, you know, we've built something remarkable in this country. This nation is actually a miracle in its own way, and it's worth defending. It's worth defending. And so I think it's important to do that, but to do it in the most efficient and effective way possible. And that's really what the book's about. I try to strip away some of the complexity of the defence debate in Australia. And where I end is really to say that, in essence, Australia is not that difficult to defend. We make it harder than it needs to be. And there is a reasonably simple formula, not easy, but relatively straightforward, that can keep Australia safe.
And that takes us nicely to AUKUS and nuclear submarines, $365 billion worth of nuclear submarines, which Hugh White has just said in the last week or so in this essay that's dead in the water. And is unlikely ever to be delivered. So it's a
the essay. The essay is called The essay is called "Dead in the Water." The essay itself is not dead in the water.
That's right. What's your assessment of AUKUS and the nuclear submarines, and I guess why that particular defence strategy was chosen by the Australian government?
Well, the question of why we went down this path is still really contested and controversial and a little bit vague in my mind. The sort of prehistory of AUKUS, like how did we get here? That's still a bit of a mystery, and I think there's a gap there for some enterprising journalists to write the first draft of history there, especially now with Morrison having moved on from government service, Boris Johnson in the UK. In the next year or two, some of the officials in Australia that were central to it will probably move on as well, if they haven't already. So I think there is a moment there for, I think, an enterprising journalist or historian to sit down and say, well, how actually did this happen? Because it's still quite opaque. Look, my sort of principled objection to AUKUS really is one about the fundamentals of Australian defence, and this is, you know, what I referred to in my previous answer. And I'll use a line here that I've used many times in the book and in talking about the book. So if people who've heard me speak about this before, I apologise if they've heard it before, but it seems to me that Australia's single biggest defence asset is distance. We are very far away from any country or any capability that would threaten us militarily. Beijing is closer to Berlin than it is to Sydney. And we often forget how far away we are. For instance, a couple of years ago, before his passing, Senator Jim Molan, former Australian Army General Jim Molan, wrote a book about the threat from the Chinese People's Liberation Army called Danger on Our Doorstep. And my response to that is, well, if so, then that's a bloody big doorstep, right? There's a huge distance that separates us. And my objection to AUKUS really rests on that point. AUKUS and the submarines in particular are effectively an attempt to compress the distance between Australia and China. Whereas what I think we should be doing is exploiting the distance between us and China. Now, what do I mean by compressing? Well, look, the signature capabilities that nuclear submarines bring are long range and long endurance. Many others, of course, nuclear powered submarines are incredibly deadly and effective. The battleships of the modern maritime world. But those are the two outstanding qualities that Australia is getting these boats for. And so I ask myself, well, how do you best exploit those two features, long range and long endurance? Well, you don't do it by using the submarines around Australia's coast. You can to a degree exploit their capabilities that way, but that's not the full exploitation of their capabilities. The way you fully exploit the capabilities of nuclear-powered submarines is to operate them close to China and where they can stay on station for weeks and even months on end. And into the bargain, we're buying long-range cruise missiles to fit on these submarines. Cruise missiles that are specifically designed to hit land targets. Now, unless you're planning to hit China, then the list of missions for these missiles is pretty short. There are other justifications, but the main one is hitting China. So altogether, what I see is a program to build a submarine fleet that is specifically designed to take the battle to China. And my simple reply is, well, in the unlikely event that China ever wants to threaten us, let them come to us. Let them traverse that vast distance that separates us from China, because that's hard work. Traversing those thousands of kilometres is incredibly hard work, and actually directing significant amounts of military force across that distance is a very difficult enterprise. So I think we're used to, I think people who pay maybe occasional attention to military affairs might think that the problem of distance has somehow been solved, you know, that advanced military powers can somehow project force over, to any place on the world that they please. And in some ways that's true, like particularly with nuclear weapons. All the major powers, all the superpowers have nuclear weapons that can reach any place on Earth. But below that threshold, and we're talking about conventional warfare, it is still extremely difficult to direct significant amounts of military force over long distances. So the simple illustration that I use in the book is that if you think of a military commander who is told by his boss, well, you need to destroy a target over the next hill and you have 500 kilograms of high explosive to do it. And so if the target is over the next hill, then that commander will probably use mortar tubes, or maybe even move the explosive in a truck over the next hill in the dead of night and then detonate it from a distance. But now let's say that that target is not over the next hill. Let's say it's 5,000 meters away. Well, in that case, he has to use artillery. And if it's 500 kilometers away, then he needs aircraft. He needs bombers. And let's say it's 5,000 kilometers away. Well, at that point, you need an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile. Now, at every point along that spectrum, the task of moving that amount of explosive onto a target becomes exponentially more difficult and more expensive. So you go from a truck to a mortar tube, to an artillery piece, to an aircraft, to an ICBM. An ICBM is a massively expensive thing. You need an entire national infrastructure to build an ICBM. We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. So all along that spectrum, it gets exponentially more expensive, and yet the actual military power that you're projecting remains constant. It's still 500 kilograms of high explosive all along that spectrum. So that in itself, I think, illustrates how distance protects us. And as I say, we are at the moment engaged in a military strategy that attempts to compress that distance, when I say it's much cheaper and easier to exploit it.
Yeah. So would I be right in saying, in a way, we've chosen offense rather than defense in a way? And the reason we've chosen offense is fundamentally, I think you say in the book, we've taken a big bet on American primacy in Asia. Is that essentially right?
That is essentially right, because of course, if it was just us, then an offensive strategy would make no sense at all. I mean, it would be madness for Australia alone to say to the Chinese, "Well, come on, we're gonna face you down, and mano a mano." That makes no sense at all for a middle power against a great power. So the only way in which an offensive strategy makes sense is if we are allying with the United States, and that's why AUKUS is such a big bet on American power. And essentially a big bet on us saying that American power, American primacy is sustainable in our region, and crucially, that America will be motivated to maintain its primacy in Asia.
And your judgment would be that neither of those things is likely to continue, that American relative power is waning, and its real interest in projecting power into Asia is more vanity, not quite vanity project, but reputational perhaps, or prestige oriented, rather than the reality of what's required to defend America all those kilometers away across the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah. So I want to be careful here to say that this is in no way a sort of anti-American book, and I think the United States has all the ingredients to maintain its position as one of the two leading world powers for the remainder of this century. It has a massive military. It has a huge, and by the standards of its rivals, a very young population that can maintain and continue America's economic growth. for an indefinite amount of time. It also has thousands of nuclear weapons, and it's separated from China by two vast oceans, not to mention it has friendly neighbours, north and south. But I would add that those are also reasons why it's not essential for the United States to take on China in the Asia Pacific. So that's really important, important caveat. America is strong, but it doesn't really have enough motivation. And because China also is so strong, because China's also so big, in fact, it's the biggest rival that the United States has faced ever in the course of the 20th century, much bigger than Imperial Japan, Nazi Germany, or the Communist Soviet Union, much bigger in economic terms. To take on a state of that stature, you need a really good reason. You need an existential reason. So what is it that China can do that threatens the fundamentals of American democracy and American statehood? And I would argue not very much. America is incredibly secure. So even in the worst case scenario where China becomes the dominant power in all of Asia, let's say the United States packed up its bags and left tomorrow and China became the dominant power, all of Asia was subjugated. That seems to me an incredibly unlikely future, by the way, but let's say it happened. Even at that point, I feel America's core national interests are relatively secure. It's not even clear that in such a scenario, America would be economically excluded from Asia, in the same way that China's not economically excluded from South America or America, the Western Hemisphere, America's sphere of influence. In the same way that Europe is not excluded from Asian economies, even though it is not, it hasn't been for decades an important military power in this region. So I don't think the economics works out. I don't think the security stuff is really compelling enough for the United States. So ultimately, for all of those reasons, my argument is, well, we can't expect the Americans to make sacrifices on our behalf. So I'm not making a moral judgment about American character or about American courage. I'm really just making a prudential judgment about its interests, whatever its core interests. And when you make that very, cold judgment, as I think American policymakers will ultimately make a very cold judgment about its interests, then I think you have to say, well, actually, we're going to have to do much more of this ourselves. The Americans won't be there for us ultimately.
I've heard some people say that the sort of Australian decision around AUKUS kind of reflects a kind of a fear of Asia, fear of China kind of thing, even, sort of background racism in Australia. It's not what I think, but I've heard that sort of argument addressed. What do you think? Do you think that's a valid argument, or how would you respond to that in terms of what the policy drivers or the influences on the decision makers were likely to be that led to AUKUS?
Look, I'm sure there are some corners of the debate where there is some sublimated racism going on. I also think if we step one slight level above that, we might say that the idea of Asia being led by Asians is so unfamiliar that we find it hard to internalize. But what I would also say is that it's not at all irrational for Australia to fear Chinese power. And it's not at all irrational for Japan and the rest of the region to fear China's power and China's ambitions. It makes perfect sense, and we ought to prepare ourselves. So I was very anxious in the book not to downplay, not to be any kind of apologist for Chinese ambitions or Chinese power. I think basically we do have to take seriously the idea that China wants to become strategically dominant in our region. My objection really is to how we've gone about trying to prevent that from happening. I think we've chosen a very strange path towards that. The riskiest and I think the least reliable path towards preventing Chinese domination, and there is a smarter way to do it.
At the risk of over-complimenting you, Sam, I guess one of the other responses I had to the book was because, like, I used to be a bureaucrat in the Victorian government for decades, and your book read like someone who had really been responsible for having to think through worst case scenarios kind of, and actually, and I guess that's what defence strategy is. No one really wants to prepare for a war, but you, to some degree, you need someone to do that job. And again, that was part of the thing about your book that I found really quite interesting. But yeah.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's a very nice compliment. I mean that sincerely. So thank you very much. And I do take that very seriously. I do worry sometimes, actually, that among defence specialists, there is there's a Leonard Cohen phrase, I am guided by the beauty of our weapons. You know, there is a certain... I'm conscious of this because I had it myself when I was younger. What first got me started in this world was simply a sort of boy's own amazement with the technology. And I still have it to some degree. I am amazed and fascinated, but these days also slightly appalled by the most exotic and innovative ways we can find to kill one another. So it's easy to be seduced by that. And I'm glad that you think that that I managed to avoid it in the book.
Yeah. So what's your alternative, the echidna strategy? Because one of the striking things about it was it's sort of more effective, it's cheaper, and it has less risk. So, but what in summary is your alternative defence strategy for Australia?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you made the distinction early on between an offensive and a defensive strategy. And essentially what I'm calling for is very much a defensive strategy. So strategists often distinguish between, I mean, strategists are as one in arguing that the purpose of military power is to deter conflict. And if deterrence fails, to win, right? So I'm basically on board with that formulation. We the whole reason we have an Australian Defence Force is so that we never have to use it. But of course, there are many ways to deter, and I argue that as a middle power that is potentially independently going to have to face off against a much bigger power in China, it's not within our reach to say that we can ever win a conflict against China. But what we can do is impose so many costs on China that it will reach the point where China decides, well, this is not worth it in the first place. And that to me is within our grasp, and that can be done in a purely defensive sense. So we don't need the capability to hit the Chinese mainland, for instance. And in fact, we want to avoid that because it's unnecessarily provocative. What we want to do is essentially develop the capabilities to negate Chinese military power. And really the only way that any foreign military power can project significant amounts of force against Australia is by air and by sea. And so that means what we need, and this is really quite an old formula in Australian defence, is the capability to secure the northern maritime approaches to Australia, the air and maritime approaches to Australia. And we do that essentially with what's typically referred to among strategists as an area denial capability. That is to say, you make it unsafe for any adversary's aircraft or ship to operate in Australia's northern approaches. So lots of surveillance equipment and surveillance assets and detection equipment and targeting so that you can basically sink ships and down aircraft that are preparing to use force against Australia. Of course, the other way that a foreign power can project significant amounts of military force against Australia is if they have bases in our near abroad. So that's another key part of the book, and a key part of the argument is that Australia needs to prevent Chinese military basing in our near abroad. And that is a serious concern, and there is good evidence that China has made some diplomatic forays in the region to try to secure military basing. There's also evidence that China is already building a naval base in Cambodia. So that makes it easier for China to project military force out into the region. But largely that's a diplomatic task, not a military one. Ultimately, you may need to neutralize such facilities militarily, but first and foremost, preventing China from building military bases in our near abroad is a diplomatic task. And it's one actually we've done with some success up to now in the Pacific Islands region. So look, my strategy is essentially defensive, and it's not It doesn't. The ADF, the Australian Defence Force, is a second order priority for mine when it comes to securing. When it comes to building that strategy, the first part of it is a statecraft strategy of building a securing our presence in the Pacific Islands region, developing a much closer strategic partnership with Indonesia, and trying to build a sustainable regional order that secures peace. And then backing all of that up is an Australian Defence Force with it, which has a purely defensive denial style military posture.
So it's kind of a pivot to diplomacy, so to speak. And in fact, you say somewhere in the book, I think, that Australia should be a diplomatic superpower rather, or powerhouse, perhaps, I think was the term, rather than superpower,
yeah.
But a powerhouse rather than, you know, pretending to be a naval superpower with nuclear submarines. But
yes, and I mean, we shouldn't understate what Australia is trying to achieve. I mean, we can talk about the AUKUS as well, if you like, and about the likelihood that it ever happens. But if we focus purely on what's being planned now, 8 nuclear-powered submarines, and as of a few days ago, announcements of essentially a doubling of our surface warfare fleet. I mean, it's a massively ambitious project, which when you put it together, let's assume it all comes off, vaults Australia pretty decisively to, you know, the top, let's say the top part of the second rank of global maritime powers. So not China and not the United States and not Russia, but up there with France, the United Kingdom, India, Japan. So we are moving onto the high table of global maritime power. What I say in the book is that I'm very ambitious for Australia, but defence policy is the wrong thing to be ambitious about, and that's why I say yes. Let's be a diplomatic powerhouse rather than a military one.
I'd like to come back to that because I guess one of the interesting, I mean, my program kind of focuses on sort of world history, which is my interpretation of geopolitics. When most people talk geopolitics, I think they're really talking world history. But as you said, this is perhaps an historic transition where, you know, Asia will be ruled by the Asians rather than Europeans and Americans and Australians. But just on AUKUS with Hugh White's recent essay, he's very negative about the, critical of the likelihood of AUKUS ever being, or the nuclear submarines ever being delivered. And in fact, also raises a question about whether the existing submarine capacity, I think they're called the Collins class submarines, will sort of become redundant in the meantime, and hence leave a great gaping hole in Australia's naval defences. Have you had a chance to sort of look at Hugh White's essay and had any particular thoughts on it?
Yeah, look, I've read it very carefully, and I, for the record, it's worth stating that I've known Hugh and we've been friends for many, many years now, and you've read my book carefully, and it's clear that the debt I owe to Hugh. I mean, we differ on many aspects. I'd say many of the details around the future of our region and about Australian defence, for instance, but the major thrust of Hugh's thinking, particularly about American resolve in the region, that's been incredibly influential on me, and I owe him a huge debt about that. So, look, yes, I read his essay very carefully, and I have I don't think I came away from it thinking I had major points of difference with him. What he does very forensically is just describe how difficult this project is going to be. So, you know, in the end, all of the strategic arguments that I have made in this conversation with you, Jeff, about AUKUS may turn out to be redundant because it will be overwhelmed simply by the practicalities of the project. So I would describe it this way, that in the Australian defence debate, there are two kinds of AUKUS sceptics. One is the strategic skeptics, which of which Hugh and myself number, but also more much more prominently, Paul Keating is a strategic skeptic, so is Malcolm Turnbull. But I would argue that, that's still a minority among commentators and defence experts. I would say in strategic terms, most of that commentariat and the experts would argue AUKUS is a good idea in theory. But then there's the second school of AUKUS scepticism, and that is those who say, well, this is a good idea in theory. However, the practical barriers are so massive that it's never going to happen. And I would say that that school of AUKUS scepticism is overwhelmingly in the majority. There are a handful of people who think we can get this done, but most of the people who publicly argue that, yes, we will get this done are people who are actually paid to be optimistic about it, which is to say the politicians who are backing it and public servants. Among sort of dispassionate observers, even among sort of dyed-in-the-wool supporters of AUKUS in principle, you will hear a great deal of scepticism about whether we can actually get it done.
So it might be, we might, the bureaucracy in Canberra might be faced with a challenge of kind of waiting for the whole thing to fall over and then come up with a new arrangement at some point.
It's funny actually to reflect.
Or pessimistic.
No, you're not being. I mean, look, what? No, you're not. You're not being too pessimistic, because after all, we've been here twice before, just in recent years. So we had a handshake agreement with Japan, and that was under Tony Abbott, and we reneged on that. And then we had a contract with the French, and we cancelled that. So why wouldn't we be back here in another few years saying this is not going to happen? I don't think that's unduly cynical. So that may very well happen. I was in Seoul recently for a conference, and I saw a lot of AUKUS envy there in South Korea. A lot of officials and think tankers there saying, well, why couldn't we get the Americans to do this with us? And my response was to be careful what you wish for. The South Koreans actually make really good diesel submarines. And so I said to them, look, in a few years' time, we may be coming to you for submarines rather than you looking to AUKUS as an example.
What about the, maybe if we talk now about the sort of diplomatic situation in terms of how Australia adapts to, and people differ about how they describe, I guess, how the world international system is changing, like American primacy is declining, or American primacy in Asia is declining, or it's a multipolar world, or... It was always a multipolar world. The unipolar moment was an illusion. However you describe it, there do seem to be these big changes going on in the world, and Australia seems to need to adapt to that, and clinging in the way that we're all being the very, very best ally possible to the United States at the moment may not be the best way to adapt. And you've got some really interesting ideas in your book around that, including like you talk about a Pacific Union as in like a sort of an economic union, if I read it correctly, of the sort of Pacific Island states, which presumably, I don't know whether that includes Australia as a Pacific Island state or, yep, and a kind of defence arrangement with Indonesia. And you even talk about like a concert of powers in maritime Asia, collective security agreement. I'm not quite sure what the right term for it is. And since you wrote your book, I mean, we've had the situation in Gaza, we've got the situation in Yemen. You know, there's the ongoing issues in Ukraine, etc. But what? How do you see, I guess, the general kind of world international security environment and what that means for the key priorities for sort of Australia to become?
Yeah, well, let me start with America, because that is, you know, that is the rock on which our security and foreign policy is so much built. And if I had to summarize it, I would argue that America is in the process of becoming a more normal great power, which is to say not an exceptional nation in having, you know, global military and strategic interests, where nothing is beyond, almost nothing in the world is beyond America's reach and beyond America's interests. I think it's in the process of actually slimming down its interest to becoming a more normal great power, which will have a sphere of influence in its own region, which is to say the Western Hemisphere, the US, and of course has some has many global economic interests, but is not a kind of global security guarantor as the US is now. And you mentioned the wars that are so prominent in our daily news feeds today. So I think one bit of evidence for the proposition I just gave you about the future of American power is actually Ukraine. On the one hand, I think we've all been surprised, myself included, about the unity and the resolve that Western powers have shown with regard to Ukraine. Unprecedented levels of economic sanctions. No one expected them to be quite so tough and far-reaching, even if, you know, after 2 years the evidence is it's not working. Still, it was quite something to even get to the point that they got to. The level of military aid to Ukraine has surprised everybody as well, including now fairly long-range systems that are, you know, pushing against the barriers, or what were previously thought of as barriers against of Russian retaliation and the possibility of Russia broadening the war. There's also been intelligence support to Ukraine, which has been crucial. Diplomatic backing, of course. But there's a clear red line there as well for the Americans. It's been clear from the very start, and it's not just Americans, it's NATO allies as well. And that is that none of them are prepared to get directly involved in the war and oppose the Russians themselves. So in the early days of the war, there was talk of a NATO-enforced no-fly zone. That was rejected because it would have brought NATO and the United States directly into combat with Russian forces. Since then, of course, we've seen reluctance to supply really long-range weaponry. That's been eroded over time a little bit, but there is still places that the US and its partners won't go because they're worried about risking a wider war. And of course, most obviously, none of the NATO powers led by the US are committing troops to Ukraine. Now, it seems to me in the Asia Pacific that there is a critical lesson in that for all America's allies. But if I was Taiwan, that would be the country that would be that I think should be taking these lessons most seriously. And what I think they should be learning is that if you get into a war with a nuclear-armed great power, you will get a lot of support from the Americans. You'll get arms. You'll get diplomatic support. You will get sanctions support. You will get intelligence support. But will you get American troops? Probably not. Now, the obvious counter argument here is, well, Taiwan is not Ukraine. Taiwan's much more important to Ukraine. But my response to that is simply, well, you maybe haven't thought through the consequences of going to war with China. You haven't thought through the full consequences, which actually ends at a nuclear exchange and possibly the extinction of the human species, right? To contemplate a war on that scale, the stakes need to be incredibly high, and it's not good enough. As important as Taiwan is for reasons that, you know, we're all familiar with, chips, access to the second island chain, all of the rest, as important as that is, it may not be important enough to risk World War III over it. So I think that's an important lesson for all of America's allies in Asia to internalize, that America's in the process of becoming a much more normal great power, and actually that they're America's alliances in Asia may start to Ukrainize, if you will, which is to say, you know, plenty of military and diplomatic support. They'll still be selling weapons and sharing intelligence, but the actual deterrence work of committing, being willing to spill blood, you'll have to do that yourself. So that's a very slow process, and the interim stage is, it's not like, and here is a point of difference between myself and Hugh White. Hugh, I think, can foresee a future in which the United States packs up and goes home entirely. And I'd confess that under Trump, that's a more likely possibility than it would be under any other president, of course. But it seems to me still the more likely future is just a steady erosion of American resolve. The troops stay in place, but American resolve declines. So the belief that we have that the Americans are there for us, that erodes. That's already eroding because of, you know, Ukraine, among other things.
I mean, is it feasible to imagine a kind of collective security agreement for the West Pacific that includes all the major powers in the Western Pacific?
No, I don't think that's realistic. I don't think that's realistic because. So let me try and paraphrase you and say what you're asking me about is the possibility of an Asian NATO. And so.
I'm probably thinking more like a post NATO. I mean, imagine. There were a post-NATO collective security agreement in Europe kind of thing.
Yeah, sorry.
Could you have something comparable in the West Pacific and so avoid the situation where you end up with a war over the current security arrangements in the West Pacific?
Yeah, apologies. I probably confused the issue with NATO because NATO, of course, involves the United States and you're talking about a sort of post-American collective security arrangement. So my answer.
Well, I mean, but presumably America could be. I mean, is it beyond the capacity of China and America, Japan and Indonesia, Australia, all the other major powers in the West Pacific to negotiate some sort of arrangement, which is less tense, but guarantees, you know, all those trade routes.
Yeah, so my answer is still no in this to a collective security arrangement that's designed to constrain Chinese power, simply because our region is too large. Actually, two factors: one, geographically it's too large, and two, economically we are all individually tied to China to an extent that makes it difficult for all of us to get together in any kind of arrangement that's designed to constrain Chinese ambitions. The geography part matters in the sense that NATO makes sense as a collective security arrangement because Europe is a unified strategic space. It makes perfect sense for the Spaniards and the Norwegians to say to each other, look, a threat against us is also a threat against you and vice versa, because it's a relatively contained and unified strategic space. That's simply not true in our region. It's much larger, much more dispersed, and a military threat against India, for instance, is in no way a military threat against Japan or against Australia, right? So let's say there's another border clash between China and India and it gets much bigger. Is there any future realistically in which we would see Australia or Japan committing troops to India on India's behalf to defend itself against China? I would say absolutely not. Not in the same way that we could imagine, say, the Spanish military committing to defend the border between Poland and Russia. That's much more realistic, I think. Than to see a similar kind of thing happening on the border between China and India. So geography is against any kind of collective security arrangement, and so is economics, because all of these countries you're talking about are much more intertwined with China economically than are the European powers with Russia, for instance. And that means none of them will want to sacrifice those economic relations on behalf of the others. So first of all, that sounds like dire news. If we can't do it collectively, how on earth are we going to do it individually, right? So my answer to that is firstly that even though distance is makes it harder to defend ourselves collectively, it does make it easier to do it individually. It's very difficult for China to project force over the oceans for the reasons we talked about earlier. Distance protects us, and it gives the defending nation a roughly 50-to-1 cost advantage over the offensive power. So if there's a power that wants to project force by sea, then it has to spend 50 times as much as the defending power to overcome those defenses. That's roughly the result of a study that the RAND Corporation conducted in 2016. Defense is cheaper than offense, right? when it comes to maritime power in particular. And big surface ships, which you use to project power, are incredibly vulnerable to relatively cheap missiles. Mm. So that's the good news. But I think the other piece of the puzzle here is that Australia in particular does need to find partners that share our strategic space. And the obvious one is Indonesia. And that's why the book calls for a kind of alliance with Indonesia, a much closer military partnership than we've ever had before. I'm actually in the process of writing a longer essay on this topic now for Australian Foreign Affairs, which will come out in the middle of the year. So it really argues that Australia and Indonesia share the same strategic space, and therefore we have, you know, roughly equal interest in making sure that China never becomes the dominant maritime power in our part of the world. And also we can help the Indonesians. We're much smaller than them, but we're much more sophisticated militarily. So we can help Indonesia to develop the kind of maritime denial capabilities that they currently lack.
I think there's an ASEAN meeting in Australia.
In Melbourne next week.
In Melbourne next week. And obviously it's just been the Indonesian election, the new president. Yep.
Prabowo Subianto, yeah.
Do those events, what's the sort of shape of that idea or the potential pathway to that idea, do you think? Where's the near-term opportunity, I guess, to take that?
Yeah. Look, it's a distant prospect, it has to be said. And in the essay, I try to anticipate some of the obvious counter-arguments, the practical objections to Australia ever forming any kind of military alliance with Indonesia. It is still far off. And I think the most fundamental one is that Indonesia and Australia just view China very differently. So Australia has, taken a much more strident stance against Chinese strategic power than Indonesia has ever done. Indonesia is a non-aligned nation traditionally. Indonesia, has a very strong economic relationship with China that it needs to protect, a large Chinese diaspora as well. And it would be a huge leap for China to go into any kind of alliance relationship that implies that it is taking a kind of anti-China position. So all of those things I accept. I guess what I'm assuming is that China's relationship with Indonesia is going to get worse over time because China's ambitions will collide ever more directly with Indonesia's interests. The obvious flashpoint is the Natuna Sea, which is a part of the Southeast Asia that is in dispute between China and Indonesia. But even putting that aside, there's a sense that China would like to be the kind of power in which other Southeast Asian nations essentially become subsumed under Chinese hegemony. And so I think there's a good chance that Indonesia ultimately is going to resist that. Even though it does take a more ambiguous position on China than Australia does, I think ultimately it is going to resist that. In order to do it, it might decide that it needs Australia's help. So I think Australia should be there when Indonesia takes that turn and when it decides to do that.
I've seen speculation that Indonesia may at some point join the sort of BRICS Plus group. Do you think that's a likely prospect or?
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't actually heard of it, so I'm not in a good position to comment. But I'll just offer one slightly broader observation, which is that Indonesia is in its own right a great power in the making. I mean, we kind of underestimate Indonesian power in Australia, but there are solid projections that by the middle of the century, it's going to be one of the top five economies in the world. What Indonesia really needs is to be able to harness all of that economic power in terms of state power, which it can't do at the moment. The Indonesian state is still relatively weak. And also Indonesia hasn't really developed a coherent foreign policy identity since the end of the Cold War. It still clings onto the non-alignment ideal, even though that's really a Cold War idea, which doesn't have that much relevance to the world we're in now. And it hasn't been forced to seek a new identity. And I guess what I'm really counting on is that eventually China will be the forcing mechanism for Indonesia to develop that leadership and that identity as a great power, which ought to provide some level of balance against Chinese ambitions.
It's making the Indo-Pacific a very fascinating place at the moment, isn't it? Because, I mean, India is arguably a great power now.
Yeah, we've... And,
you know, China's definitely so. In some ways, Japan is still, maybe, I don't know. And we've got Indonesia in prospect, and potentially even Australia could be a diplomatic powerhouse. So, but we're just about at the end of the hour. So I just wanted to say thank you so much, Sam, for an absolutely fantastic discussion about Australia's place in the world. Did you want to say one last thing, perhaps, before we...
Only to thank you, Jeff, for a really rich conversation, and I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, I hope you learned as much from that conversation with Sam Roggeveen as I did. It was a real pleasure, and a big thank you to Sam for being so generous with his time and his insights with this very, very minor podcaster and a YouTube creator who just tries to help people see the world a little bit more clearly with some quality world history. I also have another guest interview appearing on the podcast next week. Fascinating man called Warwick Powell. And we're talking a little bit more deeply still about Australia and China relationships and what it might take to improve those relationships, and how thinking about the long history of those relationships might just help us do that a little bit better. I hope you can join me next week for that fascinating interview. Until then, take care and enjoy your histories.